Okay, throughout the night, we're going to have six special guests. They've been on Coast to Coast before, and I'm supposed to figure out who they are as we go behind the secret door. Once I do, we'll get into interviewing them and taking your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, and we are going to open up our first secret door and see if I can figure out who it might be. Well, come on in. How are you?
Happy birthday, Mr. Norrie.
Oh, boy. This is going to be interesting because you're not changing your voice, are you?
It's just me here.
How many times have you been on Coast to Coast?
Guesstimate, probably 16 or 17.
16 or 17 times. Now, I'm allowed three guesses. Jason Martell?
No, sir.
Do you deal with the paranormal?
Some would say so.
I feel like I'm on What's My Line. When was the last time you were on the program?
Probably 2 months ago.
Oh, my gosh. Are you David Cereda?
No, sir, but close.
You're close to David. Are you a psychic?
No, sir.
I'm going to give up. Who are you?
David Politis.
David! I wanted to get you back for a full show. We're going to have to do that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Norrie. Happy birthday.
Thank you, sir. I got to tell you, your research into missing people at parks and other places may be the most compelling work of any guest I've ever had on.
You're very polite. I appreciate the comment.
I mean, it is. I get more emails, David, from people about this subject, and I might as well take advantage of your little visit with us here. Just what's new?
Well, probably the one thing that's bothered me the most in just the last few months is a few years ago I wrote about an individual named Daniel Trask who disappeared in the Temagami area of northern Ontario, and that's an area just northeast of Sudbury. He's a 28-year-old guy, very straightforward, great person. His dad is a firefighter, his brother's a firefighter, he's just salt-of-the-earth kind of person. And every year, since the guy was a little boy, his family used to go to this Temagami area. And he knew it like the back of his hand. There's a lot of First Nations history in that region, and a lot of history just associated with migration of individuals and a lot of sportsmen out there fishing, hunting, etc. And in November of 2011, Daniel went up there because he wanted to experience what the First Nations people called the changing of the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And he went up there, drove, parked his car, had all of the things he needed, put on his backpack, walked in, and essentially walked into oblivion. And he was supposed to be canoeing the Temagami area. It's probably as much water up there as there is land. It's really swampy and a lot of stick structures. There's pictographs on the rocks up there on Temagami Lake. And he didn't come out. And big search for him. They looked everywhere. They were unclear exactly where to look, but they flew helicopters, canines, ground searches, snowmobiles. They found nothing. So they thought they'd wait until the snow melted so they could figure out, maybe find his body or something. So in May 2012, they went back in there. And directly across from the pictographs on Lake Temagami, they found his lime green snow pants and coat. And both pieces were inside out on the upper bank of the lake. Now, the inside out part is important to me because I've had several cases where people have disappeared and their pants or their coat were found inside out, and most of the time they are never found. This was on the eastern bank of the lake, and about 300 yards away, they found a campsite that they thought was his. At that point, they didn't find anything else.
Strange.
In 2013, and there was another big search, and about 5 kilometers north of where they found the jacket and the snow pants, in a very marshy section of the lake, they found his backpack. And at this point, they knew that they weren't going to find him alive. But it was about this point that his mom and dad contacted me. And they said that they had heard about the books and they heard about the associations I had made. And they just wanted to, I think, talk it out, in which we did. And they were destined to find their son's body. And they continued searching up there. And they thanked me for being one of the few stories that actually told the truth about what happened.
You always do, and that's what we love about you, David.
Well, in May of this last year, only about 3 or 4 weeks ago, a search team from Michigan went up there and volunteered time, and they found a skull on the eastern shore of Lady Evelyn Lake, in between Wash Lake. And they had a Canadian forensic pathologist. They positively identified it as Daniel's skull. Now, what's interesting is that they didn't find any clothes around it, they didn't find any other bones around it, and it was about 5 kilometers away from the backpack and about 5 kilometers away from his clothes. And the part about just finding the skull is something that's more common than not in a lot of these stories, which somebody who hasn't read them is going to say, well, that's pretty weird. It is pretty weird.
It is weird, sure.
You know, you'd think you'd find the bigger bones of the body in the area, correct?
You would think so.
Yeah. So they're looking now for additional evidence. They're trying to get some closure to it. What's really interesting is that the Ontario Provincial Police sent their major crimes unit up there to look around and to collect additional evidence if they could find it. And that probably isn't normal. So I think that the OPP up there has an idea that something really unusual has happened, and they're trying to do their diligence on it. And the autopsy came back just on the skull, as the cause of death was inconclusive. But the kind of the keystone part of this story, along with others, is that it's been almost 5 years since he disappeared. Very little evidence is found. It's found scattered over a long area. No real answers, yet the federal police and the provincial police are taking an interest, which is something they're even starting to do in the states here. The FBI won't say that they're interested in any serialization of the incidents, but they are starting to do their investigations, which is something good.
What does that tell you, that they want to get involved? What do you think is happening from their perspective?
I think that they understand that there is serialization and there are parallels to the cases. And I know cases that go back to the 40s and the 50s where the FBI sent an agent there to monitor the cases. He's writing reports, they're going back to profile, and they're sitting in case files back there with cases that match. Now, the FBI is famous for being the greatest documentarians of law enforcement in the United States. They really do their good work. So their profilers have good things to work off of. The truth of the matter is, I think they'll realize that this is something so outside the bounds of normality that we'll probably never hear anything about it from them.
Our first guest is David Politis. I did not guess. Yeah, David's written a couple books, Missing 411, The Devil's in the Detail, and Missing 411, North America and Beyond. Frightening stories, David. I mean, I can imagine the grief that these families are going through when their loved one is just gone and just vanishes and they don't get these answers.
It's a really tough situation, especially when a family's calling you and they know you've written a few books about the topic and you really don't have anything to add to the story other than, yeah, your son's case matches a series of others. There may be some comfort in that, I don't know, but the truth of the matter is that it doesn't really point to any answers at this point. And the families of everyone that has ever contacted us has been some of the most polite people you can imagine. They're all looking for answers, and they're all stymied by the government or the reluctance of other people to step in and try to help them find their loved one. In the Daniel Trask case, it wasn't the government that was helping them, it was a volunteer group out of Michigan that eventually found the body.
Do you notice a frustration with the family members?
You know, you do, George, and I think that not finding a loved one is is, in my mind, much worse than finding somebody deceased and at least having some closure to the topic.
Yes.
And I think it's different for everybody, but in these incidents where, you know, there's vast wilderness in North America, and you look and you look and you look, and you really aren't finding anything that's pointing to anything specific, and then you have a violent crimes unit come in and say, yeah, we're going to take over the investigation, that probably perplexes them because they know that their loved one was in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
And these artifacts of the individual, you know, the clothes and shoes and that are scattered everywhere, do they look like they've been torn apart or simply removed?
Most of the time, they look like they're removed. There's a real famous case out of Colorado of a 3 or 4 year old boy named Jared Atadero that disappeared, and he was found years later, about 550 feet above a trail that he was walking on. And his clothes were found inside out, up above in a granite area. And there were rumors around that Jared was taken by a mountain lion. Except all of the clothing that was found, forensics went through it, and there wasn't a drop of blood on any of the clothing.
Jeez.
So there's a lot of those type of cases, and I think the media initially puts out there something comforting in that it can be explained, but the reality of it is that most of these can't be explained. That's why I wrote about them.
You've come up with some of your own thoughts and theories, David, on what this might be, and you've got your own feelings, of course, and everybody gets their own after they read your works. Can you imagine what it's like for that individual who either has disappeared or is taken, the horror of what they may be going through or what they see? I've tried to think about that. When you were on with me some time ago, I've tried to put myself in their shoes. It's got to be frightening.
You know, I get asked that a lot, and I've told the story before. I don't think I've ever said it on your show, is that I was with a man about 15, 20 years older than me, a very grizzled old hunter, and we were in an area of Northern California. We were a long ways from everybody, and we were both carrying rifles, although we weren't really hunting hard. We were in an area actually looking for something else, and as we're walking along, I stopped him, and I said, his name was Frank. I said, Frank, do you realize something? He goes, Dave, the forest is just dead quiet. I said, yeah, and we looked to the top of the 400 or 500 foot trees, and there's movement, but we don't hear anything. So I told him, okay, you sit on this side of the Douglas fir tree. I'm going to sit on this side. We'll watch each other's back, and we'll wait and see how long until sound comes back. About 30 minutes later, finally everything comes back to normal. Birds are chirping. You can hear the wind.
Hmm.
But in all my years, I've never had something like that happen. And he said, Dave, I've been in the woods since I was 12. I've never had that happen.
That silence in the woods is eerie.
Very eerie.
Were the reports on any of these disappearances of lights in the sky, craft around, or anything like that?
You know, that's something I always listen for and I pay attention to, and I try not to lead anybody. And the ironic part about that is that the people that have survived these things have a memory that goes up to the point where they're lost or their friends and relatives don't see them. But at the point that they're lost, they don't really remember what happened, and they can't really tell you how they got lost or how they were found. And that's a pretty consistent element. So when you ask them about specifics before or after, they really don't have any.
What percent, David, of those that disappear or are lost and then come back, what percent come back and they find them alive?
I would say that in the ones I've written about, it's probably less than 25%. And of that 25%, many of them are young kids that either can't talk, are too young to talk, or have a disability and mm-hmm. can't talk.
Do they all have a look of fear and panic?
There's something consistent right there. You hit the nail on the head. When you see pictures of these kids, their eyes are like the size of saucers in their head, and they look like they just saw something that you couldn't believe. I mentioned that in the books, and each of the times that a small child is brought out and the press captures a picture of them, they all have the same deer-in-the-headlights type of look.
Like they're in shock.
Yeah.
Let's take a few calls here for you, David, while we still have you. Fredericksburg, Virginia. Linda's with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. My question is if you've had any of the remote viewers, any of the really good professional remote viewers or any reputable psychics do these cases and what their impressions have been about what's going on. I know you're hesitant to say your opinion, but I'm curious. I'm sure somebody's looked at these.
Fascinating.
What's their impression been?
What do you think about remote viewing or something like that, David? Has anybody used them?
It's a great, great topic and a timely question. I was doing a conference, a 14 conference in Maryland last year, and Ed McGonigal was one of the speakers with me. And he was one of the Army remote viewers, and we went out and had dinner, probably the most interesting conversation I've ever had. I got my books to him, and he said that he would gladly work with me and determine what he could envision. And this was a few months ago. I just communicated with him again. He just had an operation. He said he's eager to start working.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's a great idea, and Ed's a great person, and I look forward to working with him.
You have rapidly become one of the experts in this field because not a lot of people are doing it, and you do it and do it very, very well. What do professional law enforcement people whisper to you, David, about this?
That's a mixed bag. There's some that are the nicest people in the world, will give you the shirt off their back. Every time there's an incident in their area, they'll call me. And then there's others that don't want you around, don't want you reading their reports, don't want you seeing possible mistakes they made. I'm not sure what the ideology is there, but I would say it's probably a 50-50 mix.
It's baffling. A lot of people will say, what about bears are grabbing people? But you don't see that kind of evidence, do you?
Well, that's one of the, going through the vetting process on these cases, if there's any type of animal attack, any representation that, you know, maybe there's a mental illness and the person wanted to disappear, those kind of things we vet, and if we find that, then we won't include the case in what we work. And it is a pretty easy process. When search and rescue brings in professional trackers, they can tell you if a mountain lion or bear have been recently in the area, and it's real easy to tell if there's been some type of attack. There'll be disruption in the soil, there'll be blood, you'll find hair. There's a lot of things that go along with that.
Haven't some of these people, David, disappeared almost like the blink of an eye?
Absolutely. As quick as you can imagine, parents turn around and they said they were right there, and they're gone. I hear that time after time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm beginning that there's something, my guess, something dimensional, or they've fallen into some kind of dimension. Something weird is going on here. Of course, that doesn't explain the clothes and how it's inside out and things like that, but it's strange. And I'm sure, David, that in some of the parks, you might have some murderers out there hiding, doing what they do, but the whole thing is strange, isn't it?
It's absolutely baffling, George, and I wish I had easy answers, and there aren't, but your statement about, portals and things, I've heard that from many people. I've had people tell me that they thought that they've seen a portal on a trail open up.
We've got to have you back for a full show, David, okay?
Absolutely, George. Have a great birthday.
Thank you, my friend. David Politis, he was our secret door guest number one, and I didn't guess it. I'm 0 for 1. Who's behind the secret door? Well, we tried for our first one, and I missed that, so we've got five more to go. Let's see how many I can guess. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with guest number two. And welcome back. Who's behind the secret door? Let's open up the door for guest number two. Boy, that door needs some oiling, doesn't it? Okay, come on in, guest. Hi there.
Mr. Norrie, I'm so glad to be on with you tonight.
You're Annie from Alabama. Oh, no.
Close.
Oh, well, this is going to be tough. So you're a woman?
No.
You're not?
Oh, this really, is... George?
Your voice keeps crackling. You've got to be a woman.
No.
Happy birthday, George.
Richard C. Hoagland. Unbelievable.
I'm practicing for my new career.
Was that your voice?
Yes.
Not bad.
So thank you. That's chilling here.
And I apologize for calling you a woman, first of all.
Why would you apologize?
You're not a woman. I know that. But you're not a woman.
Let me look. This is the most. You need to do a show on the biggest social aspects of the whole, Bruce Jenner thing.
Oh no, I don't do those things.
There is such stunningly interesting, deep information there about the history of the human species and who we are really, particularly as the physics is changing. And so much of this is coming to the fore now. It's right down the middle of the coast alley.
Well, you find Caitlin and get him on the program, and we'll do something.
Isn't that Tom's purview?
That is what is his jobs and Lisa's, of course. That's what they do.
Look, he wants to talk about the deepest parts of this. I'd say go with it, because there's a lot of stuff coming out that we never even heard about before.
Well, you've never steered me wrong before. That I'll give you.
I just think it's a fascinating, untapped field to do the right story.
And by the way, speaking of stories, sometime in July, you've got a huge show us.
Buckle your seatbelt. You want to do the backstory on this for folks that are maybe just tuning in?
Let's do it, because we don't have you that long, so go ahead.
Okay, well, years ago, like 7 years ago or 8 years ago, I made a bet with George in Los Angeles at the Hilton in front of how many TV cameras, like a dozen or so?
A thousand people? It's on record, if that's where you're headed.
the bet was that Obama would win. Actually, George, technically, I only was betting that he would win the nomination, not that he would win the presidency.
Well, yeah, but you won on the nomination, so you won the bet.
Okay, so that was, fast forward the film now, 7 years. I've been thinking, what kind of show, because the bet was that I would get to do my own coast.
That's right.
Host coast.
And I would do the commercials and stuff like that.
Yeah, you'd basically be producer of George.
Yeah, I mean, I'd jump in and do my commercial and then jump out again, and you'd do your show.
Okay, now, one of the things that came up was that we should probably do this in the same studio, right?
We kicked that around.
Well, did we ever make a decision?
I think we might be able to get you hooked up in an affiliate.
Oh, you mean from here in Albuquerque?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that'd be cool.
Yeah, I think we'd
That'd be a lot easier.
For you, it would be. It sure would.
Well, for everybody.
And cheaper for me, too.
And cheaper for you, yes. Because you don't have to fly us in.
See, you always come with Robin, so that's two plane tickets,
well,
a room.
Well, Robin would come, yes. Well, so Robin is part of everything I've done for the last almost 19.5
years. And this would be hours 2, 3, and 4 that I would give to you.
Yep.
And then I would just come in and do my little bridges and my commercials, and then I'd jump out again.
Well, actually, when you say just no, I was thinking 4 hours, and we might have to go long. Let me give you the big picture. Unlike the Mariner 4 flyby in 1965, NASA did not arrange for this flyby to occur conveniently in prime time. The actual closest approach of the New Horizons spacecraft to Pluto, the last classical planet of the solar system, will be at 7:50 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or 4:50 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So if we cover this live, which is what I want to do, I want to do the 13th, first hour in the 13th, and then the rest of the show is on the morning of the 14th. If we go off the air normally at, 2 a.m. your time?
Well, I'm in, in Los Angeles.
Yeah, what happens is you have reruns from, Mississippi West, and then the East Coast, when you get off the air, goes to live news and morning programs and all that.
Except, wait a minute, I just thought of something. I'll be in St. Louis, and I'm not sure we've got the capability of doing two ISDN lines.
Okay,
from
let's find out.
I may have to come back for that then.
Or we can come to St. Louis. We can hang out with you in the cave.
You mean I'm stuck with you in St. Louis?
Well, maybe.
That's the one reason we haven't done that ship cruise yet.
You could show us the St. Louis Arch. Robin and I, even though we've been to St. Louis
before.
Well,
now that's possible. That's very possible.
The gateway to the West.
We put you up at a nice hotel. I can't put you up at my house because my kid lives there with his two kids and his wife.
That's okay. Caves are drafty anyway. Anyway, so what I'm thinking of, remember when we used to do the live coverage? We used to do when we did the live coverage of the terrible Columbia disaster, and then we also did a show on the hurricane, repetitive shows. We actually went beyond the normal airtime of Coast Live on the air.
Right.
We extended like an hour, even 2 hours, I think, one of those. Because of the way the encounter of Pluto is being arranged by celestial mechanics, if we go off the air at your normal time on the morning of the 14th, we'll miss the closest approach and the most interesting possible surprises. So just for closure, it would be nice to end when the spacecraft is on the way out from the Pluto system, and then follow up the next night with me back in the interview mode, where I do like maybe an hour on what we found out for all the folks that were missing us on the East Coast and in the Midwest.
You're trying to take over the airwaves, aren't you?
Of course.
I'd have to check on that extra hour.
Okay.
I'll check on that.
Well,
you may have to come to the cave in St. Louis.
That's perfectly doable. In fact, it's really, St. Louis is one of the cities I've never had the time
it's a great
to
city.
Kind of prowl around.
Great city. And then if I needed to get you off the air, I'd just simply jump on you.
There is a downside to coming to St. Louis.
I'll be physically there, and I'll have my henchmen with me, as J.C. would say, you know. But that's possible.
So this is your birthday.
This is my birthday. This is it.
Yeah,
I feel
wow.
great for
Do you know,
George,
I found out something so amazing that's so historically interesting.
How could I miss you? How could I miss? I'm now 0 for 2. I normally get all these guests. That was good.
Okay.
You did a good job with that. Well, now, I bet the next one is Robin, and she's going to sound like you, and I'm going to miss that, too.
Well, you got what, 50-50 shot?
Yeah.
Anyway, where was I going to go? Oh, 60 years ago tonight, literally on your birthday, I found this out today and it's so cool, the birth of atomic time came upon us. Through all of human history, up until 60 years ago tonight, June 3rd, 1955, I believe, we kept time by the stars, by the rotation of the planet, you know, things rising and setting and all that. We got better and better and better and better at it. So in the 18th and 19th centuries, particularly, timekeeping was one of the chief functions of the national, you know, U.S. Naval Observatory, there where the Vice President's house now resides. And they used to literally mark time at the observatory and then send it out by, initially it was done by telegraph and then by radio. But in 1955, on the night of June 3rd, on your birthday, we switched over as a nation to atomic time for the first time, the first cesium maser that kept time so much more accurately than looking at the rotation of the stars and planets around the Earth.
And we live by that clock now.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Now, what's really interesting is that over the last couple of three decades, they've had to constantly readjust the atomic clock, which now lives, I think, in Boulder, from the celestial clocks, you know, the meridian circles around the world that basically keep track of the rotation of the Earth. And they've had to add and subtract what they call leap seconds in almost every year since the atomic era of timekeeping. It was born 60 years ago tonight. Now, obviously, the Earth is not stopping and starting by jerks of a whole second in just a year or a year and a half, which is what they're constantly fiddling with. It's like having two bank accounts and you're constantly putting money into the one to keep track of the other.
That's right.
So I asked Tom Van Plandern one day what the hell was going on, because I had my own deep suspicions at that point.
Yeah.
And you know, Tom would not tell me the correct answer.
Why not?
I don't know. I can't ask him.
God rest his soul now.
Not with us. But that bothered me, it still bothers me, why he wouldn't give me a direct answer. Because the obvious answer is either the rotation of the Earth is changing by this magnitude, or the atomic constants that govern the vibration of cesium atoms that are the heart of the clock, you know, trillions of cycles per second. Those are changing. And either one is a positive mark in favor of the hyperdimensional physics model, because in conventional physics, constants like the atomic constants cannot, I repeat, cannot change.
You are going to have fun with this show, my friend.
The one on the 14th?
You're going to have
14th?
Fun. Yeah.
Yes.
But by the way, let's take a couple quick calls, only because
I finally get to be captain.
There's one guy. You ever hear of the guy from Pittsburgh? He posts YouTubes, and I met him in Santa Cruz, California, at my event, and he did this huge video on me, but he's on the line to talk to you. He's been wanting to talk to you for God knows how long. George, out there in Martinez, California. Hey, George.
George, this is George Senda, the guy from Pittsburgh. And, oh, Richard, you ever play that game I sent you?
God, I don't even remember the game.
Marsopoly.
Marsopoly. You don't remember that?
I mailed it to you. Anyway, I got a question for Richard. Are there broken glass domes on Mars?
Yes. Uh-huh. In fact, we're inside one. The Curiosity rover, which is roving around in Gale Crater, which is about a 100-mile-wide crater, has a huge mountain 3.5 miles high in the middle of it that's almost as wide as the crater, so it's like a 100-mile, very geometric. It's an ancient arcology. It's not really made of glass. I mean, it's made a lot of other stuff. Glass is one component, but it's now obvious if you look at the Curiosity raw image data files at JPL that are updated daily with dozens of new images, high-resolution color images, that there are artifacts all over these images that are not being blanked out, they're not being obscured, they're not being fudged, they're not being JPEG to death, they're just sitting there, so that when the announcement is finally made that there's stuff on Mars, oh, by the way, and there's stuff on the Moon and all those other places.
It's everywhere.
They will have in the archive overwhelming evidence they can point to. And they can say, with honesty, we haven't been covering anything up, and 99.999% of the reporters covering the story will buy that excuse. And those few fanatics that try to point out that NASA's not always told us the truth, they will be quietly submerged in a din of acclamation for NASA's honesty in putting out scientific evidence that is so incredibly controversial. It's called political spin. It's worked before. It will work then.
George, thanks for your call. Have you seen that flying saucer that they want to take people to Mars in?
Well, it's such a misrepresentation in the news stories. I mean, talk about hype. What that thing is the aerodynamically designed descent vehicle to slow a spacecraft down, like around the heat shield on the front end of the blunt, you know, Apollo capsule type spacecraft as it's entering the Martian atmosphere. And they've been testing it in the only reasonable, accessible, and cheapest place to test it before you go to Mars, which is at the limits of the stratosphere up at the top of the Earth's atmosphere above 100,000 feet. And they slammed this thing back into the atmosphere after they inflated it. It's an actual inflatable shape, which has tiles on it and the heat shielding and material that will ablate away with the temperatures of reentry. And they're testing for a big, big human crewed spacecraft that will someday go to Mars. Now, you may say to yourself, well, why are they suddenly doing this in such a visible way? It's part of, I believe, the conditioning down the descending road, ultimately to the big doorway marked D, for disclosure. I think we see trend curves.
Gosh, I just don't think disclosure will ever come, Richard.
You want to make a bet?
Another one?
Let's see, what could I win on this one?
Think of something we both want in case one of us will win. Yeah, but we have to put a timetable on it. We can't let it go on forever. Plus, you and I are in our home stretch anyways. We're not going to be around forever.
Speak for yourself, George.
Thanks, Richard.
I'm looking to go to Mars. Have you been watching the stunning developments on the NASA We Don't Need Rockets Anymore front?
Your friend Charles Lewis sent me an email a few weeks ago and said, you and Richard need to go to Mars together. And I said, there is no way I'm going to be in a capsule with Hoagland for 2.5 years back and forth to go to Mars.
That might be a bit, you know, much.
That's too much. Too much indeed. So what else is new? How's Robin? What's up with her?
Well, at some point you will find out when you talk to Robin. It may not be tonight. You know, making guesses about who's behind the secret door could lead
you astray. You want to give that away.
No, Robin is doing terrific. Robin's show is going through the roof.
She's feeling better?
Interesting. What?
And she's feeling well? Okay, good.
She's maintaining. You know, again, as I say to everybody who sends me all the email, and I graciously thank everyone who's interested in Robin, please talk to Robin. There's nothing more personal about a woman than her health. And I do not.
Well, maybe they don't think she wants to talk about it, so they go through.
Then that's her privilege and her right, is it not?
Of course it is.
Okay, so ask Robin if and when you get to talk to her, because she will tell you exactly what she wants to tell you, and she won't tell you what she doesn't.
All right, any events or conferences coming up for you?
Well, there's some potential for this extraordinarily interesting group back east, which is actually based partly out of Houston, the NASA Eagle Group. And there's some potential for speaking at a conference having to do with alternative propellantless propulsion. But I don't know any more details, and somebody just sent me an email a couple days ago and asked me if I'd be interested. So that would be in England, so we would go back and we'd be able to measure Stonehenge and a bunch of other stuff at the same time as part of our contribution on the physics side of things.
Richard's website, of course, enterprisemission.com. He doubles duty as not only the head of the Enterprise Mission, but our science advisor, and a lot of people don't know that behind the scenes, Richard is sending me little emails and links to stories that are breaking throughout the night about science and physics and space. And you do a good job finding that, Richard.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for being behind the secret door. I'm now 0-2. You were a little too good on that one.
Thank you again.
All right. You take care of yourself. Richard C. Hoagland. Yeah, now I'm 0-2. I've got 4 more guests to go. I need to at least pick a couple of them, for crying out loud. Hey, follow us on Facebook, by the way. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at our Instagram picture of a birthday gift I received from one of our listeners. If it were a real diamond, we could buy anything in the world with it. We'll be back.